From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Last week, more than 100 world leaders, including President Obama, attended the United Nations Summit on Climate Change in New York City. Described as the largest gathering ever on this subject, the event followed a spate of sobering news from scientists, record growth in concentrations of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, and record-breaking global average temperatures. The UN summit did not result in binding agreements or even solutions, but instead laid the groundwork for formal upcoming meetings on climate change in Peru and France. Still, some major momentum was apparent, with hundreds of thousands of demonstrators streaming through city streets, boisterously calling upon politicians for real reform, and corporate leaders pledging to divest their holdings in oil and gas. However, as the last echo of declarations leaves the UN General Assembly chambers, the last placard of passionate protesters recycled, the carbon count still rising, many are left this week wondering, now what? Today in The Exchange, that's what we're looking at. And let's get your thoughts. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. We have two guests for the hour. Sam Evans-Brown is here, NHPR's environment reporter. Sam, I know you're busy. Thanks for taking time out.
Thank you, Laura.
Also with us, Cameron Wake, the Josephine Lamprey Professor in Climate and Sustainability at the UNH Sustainability Institute and an Associate Research Professor at the Earth Systems Research Center at UNH's Institute for the Study of Earth, Oceans, and Space. And Cameron, welcome back. Nice to see you.
Good morning, Laura. Good to see you again.
Well, Cameron, I'll start with you. What struck you about this recent summit in New York City and those giant, giant protests that we saw in the streets?
I really think it displays the passion that people have for the issue of climate change that is already beginning to affect them. It's beginning to affect their quality of lives. And combined with the fact that they don't see their state governments or their federal government really addressing this issue seriously. And so I think, as Bill McKibben called for, we need a movement to wake up society, to wake up our politicians, that it's here, it's now, and we have to deal with it. And on the backside of it, I would say that there's actually opportunity as we go ahead and deal with it. There's real opportunity to grow our economy, to improve our quality of life, and perhaps to have a more equitable and justice-filled future.
And Sam, you've been covering this for some time. What did you make of both the giant protests and the gathering of world leaders at the UN? I mean, there were some pretty big statements made there by some pretty big world leaders.
Well, so the protests were pretty remarkable, I'd say. I mean, 300,000 people, I think I saw somewhere that this was the largest protest of any kind on any topic in the past decade. And there's a sort of a tongue-in-cheek tweet that came across that said if this had been a Tea Party rally, we'd be hearing about it for months. But since it's climate change, you know, it's there for a week and then gone. But I think the real reason for that is that these folks don't have a vote at the table where the decisions are being made. You know, they're unlike a political rally where the folks who are turning out are going to vote in new leaders. You don't elect your ambassadors. You don't vote for the treaty at the Paris Climate Summit. So, and in terms of these being big statements, a lot of what we heard in New York actually was a lot of, I mean, these were sort of reiterations of commitments that had already been made by national governments voluntarily. And so while it is remarkable that there are that many voluntary commitments, it's also worth noting that just counting up the voluntary commitments that have been made, we're still on track for a pretty warm future unless those get more serious.
All right. And I definitely want to ask Cameron about that. But speaking of the folks who were there, the hundreds of thousands who went to New York City, joining us now on the phone is one Granite Stater who was at the demonstrations. Doug Whitbeck of Mason went down to New York City. Doug, thanks for being with us.
Well, thank you for the opportunity to speak. You've got an impressive cast on your show today.
We try. What was it like, Doug, to get down there, to gather people here in New Hampshire, you know, get on the bus, get down to New York City, and participate in such a giant event?
The whole effect was, you knew you were with a lot of people, but until you could look around and see some of the big TV screens, you really had no sense of the scale. My wife and I were about halfway back in the parade lineup, and we thought the event was starting late. It was supposed to start at 11:30. By 1 o'clock, we still hadn't moved.
Wow. But you're just standing there.
that it had started on time, and by 1 o'clock, the people at the front of the parade were at the end point. And it's just like when the light changes at an intersection; it takes a while for all the traffic to get moving.
From what I understand, Doug, you were in charge of actually getting people from New Hampshire down there, right? You were the bus captain or something like that?
Yes. 350 New Hampshire organized 3 buses to go down. There were other groups in New Hampshire sending buses as well. I believe Keene State had a bus. UNH Durham had a bus. One of the private schools had a bus. We had over 40 students on our bus. So it was really encouraging to see that students who are going to have the effects of this climate mess dumped on their shoulders were so interested in participating.
Well, you've attended a lot of environmental demonstrations, Doug. This is an important issue for you. How did this feel different?
It was bigger. It was louder. What really sparked me to go was listening to your show shortly before the primaries when you were interviewing candidates, and I heard them saying that people were not interested in climate change, and I wanted to go down and make my voice heard, and I asked a few friends to go along with me.
Yeah, to sort of prove the naysayers wrong. Well, I'm sorry to ask you this question, Doug, but I did want to ask you, how do you feel about the surveys that continue to show many Americans don't share your concern? They're much more worried about jobs or terrorism or whatever.
Well, I understand that people have their lives to live and they're concerned about their kids' grades and they're concerned about their careers. This is one reason we need leadership from the top. And this was an attempt to get their attention, and I'm still not sure we were heard, because we're still being asked to spend billions of dollars to support what's now obsolete fossil fuel infrastructure. I'm thinking here particularly pipelines.
And one more question, leadership from the top. As you know, Doug, you know, environmentalists have been kind of hot and cold, pardon the pun, on President Obama. Sometimes he seems really into this topic. Sometimes he doesn't really seem to care. How do you feel as a dedicated environmentalist about the Obama administration's commitment or lack thereof to this issue?
I think we've got the talking part done. I think we have a lot of work to do to implement some of the changes we know are necessary, and we're being held back by, I'm going to blame lobbyists and corporate interests and big money.
All right. Doug, thank you very much for being with us. We really appreciate it, and glad you got back safely.
Thank you for your opportunity to participate.
That's Doug Whitbeck, again, climate activist. He helped organize a trip to the climate demonstrations in New York City. He's from Mason, New Hampshire. You can join us with your questions and comments about what now after this giant demonstration, this huge meeting at the UN last week on climate change. 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. And Cameron Wake, to you first, picking up on what Doug said, and something that Sam Evans Brown said earlier, too. You know, we've got the talking points. Sam said, we heard this meeting reiterations of promises made already. That's not very inspiring.
No, it's not inspiring, and it's a really challenging effort to think about a problem that's years, decades in the future, and the fact that we have to act now, and then combine that with trying to get all of the different countries in the world together. It's proven to be somewhat intractable, even after the Kyoto Protocol in 1997. There was an agreement, but the United States was never ratified in the United States, and we never really acted upon it. However, I remain optimistic because I look around me in New Hampshire and across New England, and there's lots of examples where people are both reducing their greenhouse gas emissions by being more energy efficient or renewing or investing in renewable energy and saving money, or municipalities in particular are beginning to think about the future and the way that they're going to adapt to higher sea levels and more floods and warmer temperatures. And so at least in my effort is focused quite a bit on what we do at a local to regional level. We certainly need national and international leadership on this, but every citizen across the region has a role to play.
Sam, what do you think?
Well, certainly there are reasons for optimism, and there are lots of optimistic folks out there. In fact, there was just a report that came out from the Global Commission on Economy and the Climate that suggested that tackling the climate change problem might not be anywhere near as expensive as has been talked about in the past. Because of changing energy technologies, basically, the suggestion is that this can be done with no loss of GDP, essentially. And that's, you know, it's hard to know. It's modeling, it's studies, it's hard to know until we get there. But certainly there are many people who are optimistic. And I think that if you look at the sort of how challenges have been overcome in the past, it is true that the challenge always seems insurmountable until all of a sudden it's sort of inevitable that it's overcome. When you look at similar, you know, acid rain, dealing with acid rain, it was impossible, and then we dealt with it.
Yeah, this feels bigger than acid rain, according to what you hear from scientists, though. I mean, and here's a question for you, Cameron. You know, again, we hear about cataclysm, you know, melting ice sheets, flooded cities, you know, on and on and on. Here's an article in The Atlantic that caught our attention that asks, how is one supposed to respond to this kind of news? On the one hand, the transformation of the Antarctic seems like an unfathomable disaster. On the other hand, the disaster will never affect me or anyone I know, nor very probably will it trouble my grandchildren. This author says, Americans don't even save for their own retirement. How can we worry about such distant hypothetical beings and such distant hypothetical problems? This is the whole idea about, you know, how do you get people on board with this whole issue about being so cataclysmic?
So I think that's a really good point and points to why this is such a difficult challenge, is that we make changes today that we will see the benefits of decades to centuries in the future. I will say over the course of the last 20 years of studying this issue, it has become a distinctly moral issue to me, and it's precisely for the impacts on future generations. It's much like an interest-only loan, is that, you know, we're loaning out the money and our children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren and great-great-grandchildren are going to have to keep paying interest on that loan. They're going to have to keep paying for figuring out how we can respond to these weather disasters and rising seas. And so I just think that that's not a defendable position. And I think that people understand that they want a better world for their children and grandchildren. And I think that's the real key, is that there's this intergenerational issue that we really need to address.
Well, a couple more things to follow up on after a short break. And Sam, I want to hear from you on that. And also just the whole idea, Cameron, that it's so big that sometimes people feel immobilized by that. So we'll talk about that in just a moment. We're going to check in now, though, with our fall membership drive. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, a couple days out from the big UN climate summit in New York City last week, and also the giant protests that we saw on the street, we're looking at where we are at now with this issue, both in terms of the science and also public opinion and politics. Join us 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. You can join us on Facebook or Twitter, too, if you'd like. Sam Evans-Brown is here, NHPR's environment reporter, along with Cameron Wake. He's a leading climate researcher at UNH. One more time, that exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. And first up is Katie in Durham. Hi, Katie. You're on The Exchange. Go ahead.
Hi, Laura. Thank you so much. Hi to Sam and Cameron as well. I just wanted to speak from the perspective of a student at the University of New Hampshire. We, about 40 to 50 of us, went down to the climate march to represent the university and to represent our Student Environmental Action Coalition. You guys are talking right now about next steps and what we can do. And while this UN summit was great, another thing that was really wonderful happened this past week, which was the Rockefeller Foundation divested from fossil fuels. And what I see, and I know a lot of the university students at in New Hampshire feel, is that we need to have an institutional change, and that divestment's a part of that. And we're excited to bring back the campaign with this new energy from seeing 400,000 people at this march and seeing the people who went to the Flood Wall Street march the following day.
Well, Katie, thanks for the call. Two points I want to follow up on. One, Sam, I have heard about several efforts on New England college campuses to get their colleges to divest of their fossil fuel investments, so to speak. Give us a little bit more there, Sam, for people who don't know what that's all about.
Right. So this is a push that's modeled on the apartheid divestiture movement that happened, you know, back when we were pressuring South Africa to end apartheid. The advocates for divestiture say that it's actually progressing faster than the apartheid movement did. They're saying, you know, we're getting pushback, but actually more institutions are signing on earlier than apartheid did. I haven't seen the numbers myself to verify that, but that is definitely what they're talking about. And yes, we had this big announcement from the Rockefellers, you know, a couple weeks ago. But UNH and Dartmouth, there are movements in both schools or groups in both schools that are asking for that, and there has been no real progress on that front. Although the first school in the country to divest was in New England, it's Unity College up in Maine. So it's something that's happening. It's sort of out there. The folks who are advocates say it's growing quickly, but you know, it's not huge yet.
And Katie, thanks a lot for calling. Talk a little bit more, if you could, Cameron, please, about the Rockefellers. Some people said that was a big deal. I mean, the Rockefeller family, right, founded on Standard Oil. I mean, that's their whole beginnings, and now they're divesting from oil and gas.
I think it's a really big deal, and I think what they've been able to do is look at the future and realize that the future in investing is not in coal and oil and natural gas, but it's going to be in renewables and energy efficiency. And so what they're looking at is there is risk now associated with investing in fossil fuel companies.
So a little more on that, because risk, I mean, we've heard about the risk to the climate, but what about the actual share that you would buy on the stock exchange? I mean, what's the risk there?
Well, the risk there is that in the future, fossil fuel companies may in fact be liable for some of the climate change that they have been causing. And so their profits in the future might not actually be as high as they have been in the past. And so there's clearly, right, a risk associated. There's a risk associated with investing in tobacco, right? And you can see that many of those large tobacco companies have been sued for billion-dollar settlements. And so there's certainly the notion that may, in fact, happen with fossil fuel companies. I also just want to mention that sort of as part of the Rockefeller story, Arbella advisors have identified that over $50 billion have been moved from portfolios investing in fossil fuels across the nation from institutional investors. So this is, in fact, a really big movement. And just one other piece is that it's not that you can't make plenty of money on the stock market by not investing in fossil fuels. There's a whole new portfolio called Environmental, Social, and Governance, and it's been shown by the large investment firms that actually those returns can be as good, if not better, than investments in fossil fuel. So I think it's what we're seeing is the beginning of the thin wedge of investors finding other places to put their money, not only to make money, but also to reflect their social and environmental values.
At this point in time, Cameron, it seems difficult, if not dubious, that somebody would succeed in a lawsuit against fossil fuel companies, holding them liable for climate change, when a lot of Americans, including many in Congress, don't even believe climate change is happening or don't believe that fossil fuels are responsible. So that sounds like a long way off, or a difficult proposition.
Not so long way off. If you think about a court of law, it's not public opinion, it's facts on the ground. So if there have been entities that have actually blocked the progression of our society or our politics towards actually making a difference and addressing this issue, like the tobacco industry did, that they could be liable if, in fact, we can prove that a particular event is due to the fact that we put more fossil fuel into the atmosphere. And while it may not be any one particular storm, we know that sea level rise is driven by global climate change. So if we have higher seas and we have a big nor'easter and we have extensive flooding, well, there are those individuals that might take that issue into a court of law where it's not going to be public opinion. It's going to be scientific facts on the ground. Was this driven by the fact that we did not have legislation that emitted fossil fuel, carbon dioxide into the atmosphere?
Wow, well, that sounds like a whole other program there, the whole litigation and blame and whether that would actually happen. But go ahead, Sam, I know you want to jump in.
I just want to say it's worth noting that the idea that there's a carbon bubble is not necessarily reliant on this idea that you can hold companies liable. There's also...
Wait, what's a carbon bubble?
The carbon bubble is the idea that fossil fuel stocks are overvalued at this point.
And
Okay. You should divest now because there's risk in that investment that you're going to lose money. And that's one of the arguments that the divestiture movement is making. And their argument is that if you look at the proved resources that fossil fuel companies have and have verified that they can extract. If they were to extract all of that, it would set us on a course for sort of out of control climate change. And so governments, they argue, will step in and stop all that extracture. And if that happens, then those stocks are overvalued because the value of the stock is based on all of that stuff that they say they're going to be pulling out of the ground.
Okay.
So it isn't necessary that they have to be held liable for damages caused by climate change for that stock to be overvalued.
Got it. Okay. So it seems like there's a whole new or emerging angle to this subject, both the financial implications on Wall Street or wherever, and then also the legal implications in courts, maybe in this country and around the world. So go ahead, Sam.
It's just worth noting, though, that last point, that depends on governments stepping in and stopping extracture of fossil fuels.
Which doesn't seem to be anywhere
hasn't
close.
Happened yet.
We're so proud in this country, right? President Obama talks about this all the time. Hey, we're producing all this natural gas. This is great. And North Dakota's booming. And, so that doesn't seem on a close horizon.
Exactly.
Timeline, if I could put it that way. Sam, let's go to another call, and then I have another question for you guys on that. It's real interesting. Let's go to George in Effingham. Hi, George. Go ahead. You're on The Exchange.
Hi. I just kind of had a comment, and that is that I kind of find it frustrating that a lot of people are ready to protest in New York about the climate change, but then whenever there's like a large-scale green project in their community, like a big turbine farm, it's the same people that go and protest against that. And I never see any groups getting together and protesting in favor of renewable energy projects that are on a scale large enough to make an impact.
Yeah, George, thank you very much for calling. It's called green NIMBYism, right, Cameron? I mean, not in my backyard. What do you think? Are people sort of saying we need clean energy, but please don't put that up in my backyard?
Well, I chalk it up to a narrow focus and not being able to connect the issues. But I will also say that many of the really big energy projects can potentially negatively impact people who live very close to them. And so what I have argued for and continue to argue for is a much sort of broader approach to the issue. Let's have a statewide conversation on, do we want wind on our mountaintops? If so, where is that going to be? How do we take some of the financial resources or profits that come from those and actually help the people who are being impacted the most? So I think the piecemeal by piecemeal approach to big wind, especially in this state, ran into some significant problems of people saying, not in my backyard. And frankly, I think rightly so. I think there needs to be a much broader statewide effort at figuring out what communities want these and how they're going to be compensated for the impact.
Not just big wind, big hydro too.
Big hydro as well.
Sam?
I was just going to say that you will find dedicated environmentalists who will argue against terrestrial wind power. So I'd say it's not quite so simple as they're putting a stop on things that will make a real impact. These folks are saying the impacts of big terrestrial wind are worse than the benefits is the counter argument to that point. I'm not advocating that point. I'm just saying that there are real environmentalists with considered and thoughtful positions that have come out against big wind.
And I think it's really important that this is the discussion we have to have. These bigger discussions about where our energy is going to come from in the future are exactly where we need to be going, as opposed to the discussions, well, are we causing climate to change or not? Science has proven the latter, and now it's really to get on with the detailed discussions of how we're going to solve the problem.
So Cameron's description of the discussions, more sort of reason than these arguments perhaps that we hear, Sam Evans Brown. Okay, if we want wind, where and how do we help the people that are impacted? What about the governor's 10-year energy plan that just came out, Sam? Does it sort of attempt to look at this in the holistic way? We all want to get off fossil fuels. How do we do that? How do we do that in a way that doesn't make some people incredibly upset and harm their futures, perhaps?
So the governor's 10-year energy plan, where it really focuses, is on energy efficiency. And the reason for that is that if you were to look at, okay, we're going to have to build a new power plant in X number of years. Instead of building the new power plant, what if we took the dollars that we were going to use and spend that on using less so that we didn't have to build the new power plant. If you make that calculation, energy efficiency comes out very well. It's much cheaper to avoid growth in electric demand than to create new generation. And so that's one area where they've sort of, I think, gotten the big picture correct. In terms of figuring out where to site new renewable energy projects, it really doesn't go there because where developers are allowed to site things is based on, you know, where the land is, who owns the private land that they're developing. There's no legal framework in which you can build the kind of plan that Cameron's talking about. There's no way to say, okay, wind developers, you should all go over here because these are the mountains that no one lives around. They just go where they can, where the transmission lines are and where the good sites are, you know, coincident.
Yeah, so there's economic reasons, power efficiency reasons, and then you've got the feelings of the people nearby. So it's
right.
Hard to put all that together. It sounds
yes.
like that's what you're saying. Thank you very much for the call, George. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter if you'd like. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Cameron, just getting back briefly, if we could, to the idea that, you know, someone could hold a fossil fuel company liable for damages due to climate change. And again, that's a big topic. But I'm wondering about just the connection between these individual weather events we see with climate change. Every time there's a big storm, a big flood, a big blizzard, whatever, some people say, look, we've always had extreme weather. And look at the blizzard of 38 in New Hampshire. That's the one everybody talks about. And even some climate scientists are hesitant to make the connection between climate change, carbon, and that terrible, you know, Hurricane Sandy or whatever. So can you help us out with that? Because people seem hesitant, even in your field, to make that link.
Absolutely. So I think the first thing to appreciate is, and Mark Twain explained it very well, is the beauty of New England's weather is the dazzling uncertainty of it. So we have significant day-to-day, week-to-week, month-to-month, year-to-year variability. So there's lots of variability in the system. And in fact, we always have had these extreme weather events. And so it turns out to be very difficult scientifically to say that any one event is due to any one factor, such as global warming or the explosion of a volcano. And so science continues to try to do this. It's called the science of attribution. But it's really difficult because of the variability within the system. So what we as climatologists do is begin to look at groupings of events as opposed to any single event. So is the number of hurricanes that strike the east coast of the United States going up or going down? Is the number of extreme precipitation events changing over time? So we can look at groups of events, and what we found specifically in New England on extreme precipitation is we can't prove any one of those events, but the increase in extreme precipitation is entirely consistent with our understanding of a world that's been warmed by greenhouse gases because it's warmer and we can evaporate more water into the atmosphere. One of the areas where attribution has been very powerful is in extreme heat events. So there's a recent report that came out of from NOAA that looked at heat events, and they show that of all five of the sort of the global heat events that have occurred, they are much more likely to occur in a world warmed by greenhouse gases. But essentially, it comes back to the variability within the system. And so what we're seeing is that those extreme events are occurring more frequently and they're bigger. And frankly, we can't wait till science can prove it definitively on every particular event. We really look at the broader change and we see this broader change. It's really consistent with our understanding of global warming.
All right. More in just a moment. We're going to take a couple minutes now, though, and check in with NHPR's Fall Fund Drive. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on The Exchange, we'll replay for you our conversation tonight with U.S. Senator Jeanne Shaheen, part of our Rudman Center Conversations with the Candidates series. By the way, you can email us your questions for Senator Shaheen before tonight's event, exchange at nhpr.org, or put them on Facebook or Twitter. Again, that's the Rudman Center Conversations with the Candidates. And tonight, it's Jeanne Shaheen. Right now in The Exchange, we're talking about climate change, given the big UN summit on this topic in New York City last week and hundreds of thousands of demonstrators streaming through the streets. Join us, 1-800-892-6477. We're taking your questions and comments about where we're at now with this issue. 1-800-892-6477. A couple emails came in during the break, gentlemen, and here's one from Tom. He says, would your guests care to weigh in on our society's actions on climate versus our words. For example, Tom says, I often find the driver in the hybrid next to me on the road is accelerating the fastest as the light changes to green, and often the fastest driver on the interstate. Tom says, also, I can't help but scratch my head as to how an outdoor, unenclosed, and refrigerated ice rink in the seacoast can be viewed as environmentally responsible in this day and age. Our words and actions just don't seem to line up. And there's a lot of little things like that, too, you know, that you think, Cameron, if people are really concerned about climate change, why would they have their offices turned down to 55 degrees in the summertime when it's warm outside? So there are lots of little things. Thank you, Tom, for the email.
I think there are lots of little things. I think focusing on the little things is really distracting us from the bigger picture of what we need to do. And so my sense is that we're really not all pulling in the same direction. And if you want to find out that, you know, you don't have to worry about climate change, there's plenty of blogs or places you can look at on television that shows you that's not important. But I think we do individually have a responsibility to really show the way. And so perhaps that Prius driver is driving fast, but they're also probably getting twice the miles per gallon that you're getting. I think the opportunity for children to skate outside in Portsmouth far outweighs sort of the release of greenhouse gas emissions to the atmosphere, because they are going to have an appreciation of New England culture that, frankly, is going away. And in my if I could say how that energy should be produced, it should be a carbon neutral skating rink. We can generate the electricity for that outdoor rink completely from renewable energy. The city of Portsmouth could invest in that, and that could solve that issue.
But you could get people to agree on that renewable energy. We talked before the break about how hard it is to get various hydropower, wind power, and so forth projects cited.
Certainly, but I purchase all of my electricity from renewable sources, and I pay a premium for it, and I'm willing to pay that premium.
All right. Well, Tom, thank you for the email. Did you want to jump in there, Sam, on Tom's thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of a tough topic, because you don't want to tell people that their actions don't matter, but at the same time, each individual's actions really don't matter from a climate perspective. I mean, you can't – your individual impact on the whole system is not going to be enough to change global warming. And that, of course, is something that some folks in the climate community are at this point realizing and saying, that really what we need is sort of a game-changing technology to get ourselves out of this.
Wow, wait a minute, Sam. That's pretty radical, because I've been told, like, you know, turn your thermostat down and wear a sweater and ride your bike to work and,
sure,
you know, buy a fuel-efficient car.
And if everyone,
you're saying don't bother?
If everyone does that, you know, you will see climate, you will see the greenhouse gas emissions from a country fall, if you could get an entire country on board. But we've been saying that for decades, right? And what impact has it had? So the question is, if, you know, saying this over and over is not going to get enough people to change enough, then what do we do? And the answer to that is you need some sort of technology that is going to change how much greenhouse gases our society emits for living the way that people seem to want to live.
So some sort of amazing alternative to oil, coal, and gas.
A lot of people point to carbon capture, you know, putting a tube on the top of a power plant and pumping it underground. I mean, there's lots of disagreement as to how you get there, and that's why we haven't solved it yet.
All right. Enough to keep you busy. Cameron, I know you want to jump in, and then I have another email.
So I'm going to disagree a little bit with Sam here. I think that individual action is critical. And while he's right that any one person doing it doesn't make a difference, if everybody does it, that is the difference that needs to happen. And we need leaders and champions in our community. And I'll just say the work that we've done over the course of New Hampshire and the light bulbs, I know that you've changed, Laura, we actually have made a difference in New Hampshire, and we're seeing a decoupling of our greenhouse gas emissions from our economic growth. So we don't need that big new technology here in New Hampshire. We've already shown that in investing in energy efficiency and the renewables that we've developed have actually made a significant difference in our greenhouse gas emissions. And I think that really needs to continue. There's a whole number of technologies while any individual one won't solve the problem, when they're brought together, will help us solve the problem. And the big challenge with carbon capture and storage is that it costs lots and lots of money, and as Sam said, much more than investing in energy efficiency.
It's so tricky, though, when you talk about individual decisions, Cameron, because Tom, our emailer, says, hey, what about that outdoor ice rink? And here you are leading UN excuse me, UNH climate researchers saying, well, I would go for the outdoor ice rink. So you know what I'm saying? It's tough to decide which individual action matters and which individual action doesn't. You can kind of drive yourself crazy.
Well, it's not about wearing a hair shirt. It's not about using energy, right? It's actually about improving our quality of life while creating sort of economic opportunity. And if we as a society decide that we want to go down that pathway, there have been plenty of studies and experiences on the ground that show that we can do that. We just need to all be pulling in the same direction. We can all skate outside and we can reduce our greenhouse gas emissions at the same time.
All right. Well, speaking of pulling in the same direction, as you gentlemen both know, and we talked about this earlier, a lot of Americans think that it's not worth pulling in this direction. They're very skeptical that this is going on. They see a really cold winter last winter. They see a kind of cool summer this summer. Here's an email from Jack. He says, I realize it is fashionable and politically correct to regard skeptics on climate change as rejects from the Flat Earth Society. But Jack says there is a legitimate other side of this debate that this program is ignoring. Is there no one in the state of New Hampshire who is skeptical about the evidence of climate change, much of it offered by some of the same experts who are warning us of global cooling, i.e. a, quote, new ice age, 40 years ago? Jack, thanks for the email. And he attaches an article, guys, from, he says, joint letter to NASA administrator blasts agency's policy of ignoring empirical evidence. 49 former NASA scientists and astronauts sent a letter to NASA's administrator Charles Bolden last week, admonishing the agency for its role in advocating a high degree of certainty that man-made carbon is a major cause of climate change while neglecting empirical evidence that calls his theory into question. So Jack attaches that from The New American to his email. Sam, let's address this. Jack, thank you very much. You know, you guys talk about pulling in one direction and all working on this, but some people feel like, you know, not only I don't have time to think about it, but I don't even think this is a problem.
So I would say that the fundamental assertion of that email, that there is still disagreement as to whether greenhouse gases are causing or are the major cause of climate change, is false. That you know, you can pull together 50 people to sign a letter to NASA that says that. The question is, who are those people and what credibility do they have? You know, I haven't seen the letter in question, but you know, the idea that there's major disagreement on that point is frankly just false. There is still disagreement in climate science. I'd say that the big sticking point still is this question of climate sensitivity. And that's why when you see the IPCC's assessments, the International Panel on Climate Change, they'll tell you that, you know, given the amount of greenhouse gases that we're putting into the atmosphere right now, you know, we're going to see warming on the order of 3 to 5.5 degrees. And that's a big range. The difference between 3 and 5.5 is a lot. And so those are the questions that are still being sorted out. How much warming are we due to see? You know, what exact impact is there likely to be because of this warming is still very much getting sorted out.
Okay. Jack, thank you for the email. Cameron Wick, last question for you, and then we have to close it out after this big New York City summit and the demonstrations and so forth. Where do you hope this goes next?
I would say three things. First, I hope that we hold our politicians' feet to the fire based on what the overwhelming body of scientific evidence has said that shows that humans are the main driver of the warming that we've seen over the last 3 to 4 decades. Second is, I hope if they don't act, we continue to see rather big marches. Third, while I hope something happens in Paris for the UN negotiations, what I really hope for is that we here in New Hampshire can show the rest of the country and the rest of the world on how you grow your economy, how you improve your quality of life, and how you reduce your greenhouse gas emissions. We're already doing that. We just need to do more of that.
Okay. Well, lots more to talk about, guys. Thank you very much for being here. Really appreciate it.
Anytime, Laura.
My pleasure.
This is The Exchange on NHPR, checking in now with our fall fun drive.